Good evening. Here we are, Chapter 7. It's Wednesday. It's Life in the Labyrinth. And I guess I've been through this book, I don't know, a couple of times over the last 20 years. And each time, part of me thinks it's going to get easier as we go along. And in a certain way, you can say this chapter is easier. It's less technical, in a sense, than the chapter 6, which we've just finished, regarding time. But this one talks directly and gives us an enormous challenge. This is chapter 7. It's called The Mystic Vision. And this puts us firmly into undiscovered territory. So without further ado, I'd like to get us started. And Ivan, would you like to read the header there for us? Yeah.
The Mystic Vision. The veil is not in the mind, but in the heart. Only the heart will lift the veil. When this happens, when we have softened and ripened, we will find ourselves to be at the very heart of the labyrinth for which we have longed all our lives.
We could spend the entire night on that series of lines, that header, and delve into, and we can each work with, and it's only when we work individually and together and in a sense declare our positions that we get the most out of this. There's, for instance, the phrase, when we have softened and ripened, is literally another, for purposes of what we're doing here, it's another technical term. We say a technical term, but who cares? What's important is how does that term relate to you? How does it work in your life? Yet we read it, and it's kind of an intuitive leap. Did you sense that? That you understand what it means? When we read these things, we think, here's an intuitive leap. An intuitive leap towards something that we kind of already know. And then this strange phrase, the heart of the labyrinth. We barely even know what the labyrinth is, and yet we find ourselves to be at the very heart of the labyrinth for which we have longed all our lives. There's sentimentality. There's nostalgia. But then there's a certain kind of yearning that the only way I can put it is that there's a magnetic resonance for a different position to be in. So when I read that, that's what I get out of it. And it's so closely aligned in the human biological machine to the sentimentality, the good old days. That's confusion.
Yeah, right. I was going to say it's not sentimentality.
No.
There's actually, that's funny. You made me, it reminded me of a, what would you call it, a link, a parallel to this where, you know, E.J. talks about those Spanish Civil War songs. He really loves these songs from the 30s that Pete Seeger and the Almanac Singers recorded.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, I happen to know one of them moderately well because my mother always used to sing it. So, but the thing that he says about those songs, they're, you know, they're expressing political, you know, it has to do with the Spanish Civil War and against Franco in the 30s. They're like political sentiments, but what EJ says, which is, you know, absolutely the case, the melodies, those are folk songs, you know, they're flamenco, actually Moorish, very old Spanish song melodies that are taken, and they've made, given new words, you know, for the, to make them political songs, but the melodies themselves express a yearning, is what he talks
yes.
about, which is like, which is like the yearning to be home, the yearning to be, you know, back in the waking state. The yearning to be essential, again, it's what is lacking in life.
Right.
So even as, what he says is that even as a political statement, even the song that expresses, you know, down with Franco and all that, it still, it actually carries, because of that fairly either medieval or even ancient roots of those tunes, they're expressing a yearning to overcome separation. It's like Rumi, like the Rumi. Reed, the sound of the reed, you know, for the
there's
the
a
reed
potency,
for Rumi, yeah.
The neigh. And there's a potency in wanting to think of that this is very ancient, this is old. For me, the potency is that it reflects a deeper part of the essential self. That's all. So anybody doing that today, modern, is doing the same thing. It's invoking that sense of yearning. So we're going to delve into this, but this is, we've gone off the beaten path certainly now, and we are starting to stride along the paths of the labyrinth. I think I'm going to read a quote.
I think you are too.
From where I got started in some of these things was in the study of Christian mysticism, and then the Christian mystics were it was very rich, and there was a period of time, the golden age of Christian mystics, partly because they were allowed to flourish, particularly in Spain and actually Germany and mostly. But I'm going to read a couple from a great book, which I think is the classic study of mysticism, and the book is called Mysticism by Evelyn Underhill.
Oh, yeah.
Really a profound volume if you ever get a chance to study it, because she goes through and really studies these giants of labyrinth voyages that they are, and tries to bring reason to that chaos to help us reach into that world from where we are. Really well done. When love has carried us above all things, we receive in peace the incomprehensible light, enfolding us and penetrating us. What is this light, if it be not a contemplation of the infinite and an intuition of eternity? We behold that which we are that which we behold, because our being, without losing anything of its own personality, is united with the divine truth. Ruiz Boyack.
Ruiz? Who?
Ruiz Boyack, a giant German mystic.
Okay.
Man, RUYSBROECK. Man is the meeting point of various stages of reality. Rudolf Jukin. So these, in this volume, Mysticism, this is the focus of it, is the voyage of these, what I call these giants, these geniuses of the mystical state. So let's delve into this a little bit. In the first couple of paragraphs, we're deep into it. In reality, we already have a life on a macro-dimensional level, although we may not be aware of it, nor how to take advantage of it. In any case, verification will come from our voyages through the labyrinth, which will soon lead us to ascertain for ourselves that we cannot go where we are not already. Is this not the quote that I just read?
I heard it in there. Yeah, I heard
the
that
same
idea.
Sentiment. And that our potential presence in the macro-dimensional defines the sum totality of our whole possible spectrum of reality. So what's being implied here is, if you can envision it, if you already can see it, because you are already there, it's already in you. If there's a truth to that, think of the potency of that concept.
Well, that what goes along with that is the Buckaroo Banzai aphorism, but wherever you go, there you are.
Wherever you go, there you are.
Except that I think this one is, wherever you are, there you go, is actually
well,
what it is.
Well, that is more accurate, I think, Ivan, and we're going to see that.
Yeah.
What's that?
Yeah.
they work together. But we're going to see that the way Ivan formulated is more potent because we'll see in
well,
a few paragraphs.
Well, I think what he's saying, this paragraph you just read, he's saying that you can only go to those places. You can only voyage to those places where you have a presence, where you already are macro-dimensionally or something.
And there's,
where you,
there's
where you have
there's an implication that we are already there.
Yeah.
That we all we have a place in a sense in those chambers.
Yeah, exactly.
We have a place in those chambers. So there's something why aren't we there all the time? Why aren't we out there all the time?
Yeah, I think we get into that in this chapter too.
Having made the transition to Labyrinth Voyager, one comes to see and recognize one's own multidimensionality. Before I get into that last phrase, I just want to emphasize this thing. Having made the transition to Labyrinth Voyager, this author isn't giving us any room here, is he? He's saying, boom, you're there. He's saying, quit messing around. You're already there. Accept the burden of being there and the heat of it. And this is the brilliance of, I think, this writer and what EJ is saying in this volume here. He's saying, embrace the fact. Now, that's not an easy thing to do, as we'll get to as we go along. And you may or may not have seen the email I sent out. But it's not, that doesn't mean it's easy. This is not a New Age plea, love one another type thing.
No, well, that's what EJ has said many times. It's called we call this the work. It means it actually could be very, very lucid, very simple. You know, not hard to understand, but not easy to do.
Okay. So not only is it not easy to do, it's not easy to hang out there once you can do it. And that's what the chapter is about. But before I go there, I want to say that so we're being invited to say, once you are the Labyrinth Voyager, are we already there? Then this next phrase, it says here, recognize one's own multidimensionality. And I strongly urge everybody, as Harry and Susan and others have done, to go and look at the postings on Chapter 6, and particularly what George had posted. And I was wondering if George, could you expand for us a little bit? Would you be willing to on this phrase, one's own multidimensionality?
Let's see, one's own multidimensionality. Our historical personality is intentionally designed to deal with multiplicity and diversity. That is the impressions and stimulations from an outer world coming to ourselves. What we are attempting to do is fall back or fall towards our essential self, which perceives the unity of everything existing. So here's a spectrum from one end, unity, to the other end, multiplicity and diversity. And I suppose if we're able to blend those two, then we can experience the multidimensionality of real life.
There you go. Yeah, and I think that's important to, we are starting to, in a sense, hold ourselves in two places at the same time. And that takes a different form of looking, okay? One can see how the topological connectivity of macrodimensional chambers is provided by morphological corresponding to the macro inhabitant. That's actually an important phrase. I don't know if we want to get into it right now, but it has to do with one's ability to shapeshift. By shapeshift, we're talking about a movement from a dimensionality shift here. We talked about that a little bit in the last chapter, but where movement is dimensional, Okay, it's not. We're gonna be talking about seeing things and moving, and but they have a different context in when we're standing in the what I call the chambers of eternality. Okay.
Yeah, I just like to add a footnote. it strikes me that the EJ's painting is very relevant to this, to grokking, you know, to following the thread of
nice.
This idea here, because so many, I believe, of EJ's paintings, when he talks about them, they represent as a figure in a room, and they're meant to be archetypal or macro-dimensional figures, and this is this macro inhabitant strikes me as exactly what
yeah.
those odalisques that EJ's painted, and he's done whole series of rooms like the one that's on the cover of Seven Bodies of Man, or what is that series called? Yeah, the planar contiguities where, okay, the macro inhabitant of that room is on the walls. It's like the room, the chamber and the macro inhabitant are joined.
That's right. Thing.
And so, you know, it's more. That's definitely a morphological stretch or something.
And David, if I could just throw in another image that's often occurred to me as I read this chapter is imagining myself stepping onto an elevator, say, off a busy city street, downtown New York City, let's say. So you step onto that elevator, and it will take you up 100 stories to the top of, well, the World Trade Center. Well, at each floor, as your vision looks out through this glass elevator, it readjusts to its elevation, and therefore your presence adjusts to accommodate the new perception. So once you're on the 100th floor, your essential being at the heart of the labyrinth has a comprehensive view of everything. Your presence expands to fill it, and yet in the residue of your mind is the remembrance of the fact that you stepped off a busy street with a sub shop and people and crowds and. As you got started when you were in your historical personality, and that also kind of represents multidimensionality. How
well
can you put in floor levels in your personal elevator in order to determine exactly what you want your view to be and thereby your morphological presence?
A side note to what Silverdale is telling us that I'd like to emphasize is that when you to use that example and to take it
right.
even one step further, as you're making that move up the elevator, you're aware of the movement up the elevator. You're aware of transit at that time. One of the things that we will do as we work with the concept of being a macro-dimensional voyager is the concept of being aware of the transit moment. Okay? Just plodding along, just the next paragraph. In the stillness of the macro dimensions, we progressively come to the question of the very existence of the lower dimensions. They seem dreamlike, something contained in the deep subconscious of the voyager, false memories of spatial and temporal experiments that never really happened, a temporary escape from the eternity into the fantastic. Oh, man.
Yeah.
So once you're there and you glance down to that first floor where you came from and you just kind of wonder, it's like, why was that significant? What was the significance? I don't recall. In the macro dimension, one is, and here one remains, in a single chamber containing all eternity. The duration of creation is single breathing cycle. And jumping ahead, mystics, both knowing and unknowing, voluntary and involuntary, are destined to perpetual frustration if they attempt to communicate to others their visions. There's a whole chapter that Evelyn Underhill has in Mysticism where she's cataloging and discussing the unusual phenomena that occurs with these mystics. We'll get into that more as we go through this chapter and we touch on some of the concept that the author is telling us, like the palace. We see that a little bit later on. So keep that in mind as we go through. But because this isn't the first time this has been discussed, here we are in the year 2012, and I'm talking about Christian mystics that were vibrantly working in this manner 500 years ago. So this is not the first time this voyage has occurred. Many voyagers have returned to tell the tale, to this little corner of the labyrinth in which human primates huddle together in fear of darkness. Far below, the shining, stunning brilliance of the actual vision is there. Ordinary life appears dull and colorless. I'm just jumping around a little bit. And then going ahead, therefore, it is not without some dread that we must resolve to continue our dangerous explorations, no matter how safe they may appear. It demonstrates a healthy respect for reality to understand the perilous risk, the sheer danger of which we are trying to accomplish. This is not a game for dilettantes. I want to stop there and ask you, what's dangerous? I thought all these mystic things were like cool and groovy and these wonderful visions, you know, get to see God and stuff.
Yeah.
Right?
Like the 60s. Yeah.
Isn't that neat? So what's dangerous? Can you please, is anybody answering, what's dangerous? Why do we always hear that phrase?
You know, Dave, I might suggest that if we go back to my illustration of creating a dimensional elevator, here we are on the 100th floor where our attention is completely diffused across the whole of everything that we're in the middle of. And our historical personality accidentally bumps into a burly guy in our immediate physical reality. We can actually be torn between, do we respond with infinite love for our mistake and their response, or should we scoot down the elevator to ground floor quickly and run away?
Right. So... And there is some of the concept of why is it dangerous? What is it dangerous to? I mean, are we not loving to be bathed in that? Are we yearning to be there? And we go there, and so what's dangerous about it? Take the time to put that in the log. Actually, put your fingers on the keyboard and type. Click in the box first. And type, because others come after you. And this moment right now, we've gotten our way to, we've walked to the place where we can ask the question, what is dangerous? Why is this dangerous? The great analogy to work with from Silverdale. But now, how is it dangerous for you? There are, I don't know all who's on the chat, but I know at least three people who specifically had that question and have worked their way partially through it. So, big question that comes up then in this chapter. And it's like an initiatory question because it's we're being told, we're kind of giving a forewarning. Something's happening here that's really different.
Well, I think that it's dangerous because you can never fully go back to sleep, and so your ordinary life loses its meaning.
That's so potent, Susan, that particular point is enormously important. It's, what is a voyager? If we become a labyrinth voyager, think about it for a moment. What word am I using there? There's an adjective, but then what's the noun? The voyager.
Voyager.
I am a voyager. Where does the voyager, if you truly are a voyager, where do you go home to? Ivan is shaking his head.
I'd say home is everywhere and nowhere. I mean,
the nomad rests on the trail, but there is no home. The voyager has no place to rest their head. Thus, we begin to open the door to some of what is dangerous about it. Because if we embrace what our brave fellow voyager Susan is talking about, we have left an inner world of sanctity, some people call it sleep, to this vibrant world, very alive world, of the labyrinth voyage. We can act on the assumption that if we can access macro dimensions, if we can access macro dimensions, then we rightfully belong there, that we have some sort of natural existence in these dimensions, and can somehow make a place for ourselves by arising from our somnambulant state, waking from the lower dimensional dreams and learning to become useful and responsible with regard to our fellow macro chambermates. What does that mean, Ivan? Become useful and responsible. And I know that, I don't know if Aria is there, this is a point of conversation that we've had in the past. How then do you take what you have garnered and bring it back and become useful to your macro chambermates? Nice phrase.
Well, I think it means, it certainly means becoming useful in the voyaging process. I mean, in the voyaging state, the macro inhabitants of the
yes.
chamber are what you're becoming absorbed in. So then, I think that he's raising the question of whether you just become like an observer, a bump on a log, or something. You're just like a fly on the wall, or something like that, or do you share responsibilities?
In that macro dimensional space,
yeah.
What's something that you know you can do? We have two tools. You have a 50-50 chance of getting it right. We have attention and presence. And one thing we can give is our attention. We cannot go where we are not already. That is not a typo. Properly, we do not voyage from the lower dimension to the higher dimension. We awaken to find ourselves in the macro dimension where we were, always were, where we always were, taking off for the moment the Nandi-like coils of occlusion. What a phrase.
That's something from Hindu mythology?
Nandi,
I looked it up at one time, but I don't know
yeah.
what it is.
But it's, so once you find yourself there, in a sense, you look around and you go, you see, oh, why haven't I just been here all along? So it's not a linear voyage where you go from one place to another, but it's this spiral that I always refer to of suddenly you're more awareness, you're more present, and that space appears then, and you have dropped these coils of occlusion. This is why certain events seem so natural, like we recognize them. This is my own notes. We suddenly kind of recognize we have a kind of a memory that occurs. We call it a memory, but it's actually a recognition of a space in ourselves. And when we get into these deeper areas, we call them, all that deeper means is that they're voyaging spaces we haven't been to for a while. But suddenly we're there again. We're suddenly there and we place ourselves there. The part of our job is to allow ourselves to be there for a moment.
You might say also, here's a hypothesis that the deja vu sensation that this is happening again, that I'm repeating this,
yes,
moment, or I'm in this chamber, it's very familiar, and so on. You know, that could be a phenomenon of being partially up that elevator,
yes,
what George is talking about. The you know, it's a partial awakening phenomenon.
Exactly.
Yeah. But because you, it's a perception that you're returning to some place that you've been before. Whereas I think that what EJ is describing, the full awakened experience is, I've always been in this place.
I've always been in this place.
And I just wasn't, I was just dreaming, distracted from it.
So we often have these events, and what we do is we try to use our human biological machine to interpret it. Because that's what we have. That's what we're used to. Oh, something like this happened before. We're not recognizing it's actually an inner state that we're reflecting on. Jumping ahead, finding one's way around these macro dimensions is no different after some practice than finding one's way around an average contemporary high-density primate city.
Without being able to speak the local dialect.
Yeah, without being able to. And you can, and this can further lead us to the urgent need to know what we can become and where exactly we can become it. Now we start to, what is the particular signature? And some individuals are starting to unravel that signature and have a sense of what that signature might be. And then jumping ahead, without the foundation to support it, maybe I should read that.
How far ahead are you going?
Just one paragraph. I'm going to jump that ahead. I'm not going to read that. A couple of more paragraphs then. Once in a while in the course of ordinary life, the dimensional veil is lifted, and we find ourselves in the palace. We discover ourselves, hearts open and achingly receptive, sitting at the center of the labyrinth in a palace of incomparable beauty and grandeur. We realize that we have been here all along because the kingdom, the macro dimension of all possible attention and present, is always at hand. So this achingly receptive, that's the yearning. We desire to be there. This is the specific, the alabaster palace that we enter then, the grand palace that is before us. And here is where the beginnings of where our work might be revealed to us. We all have recollections, waking and dreaming, vivid and vague, of the palace. How regrettable that we should experience any distance at all between ourselves and the palace. But we have to live with the sad fact that where we think we are is where we think we are. Do we understand this? Do we understand? We create our own world. We create it by our thought occlusions. So this is a very critical transitional chapter here. We have thought occlusions. Where do they come from? That whole work we did on HBM, and I think George has given us the phrase, we always, the historical personality. We've been built up to use this historical personality. That doesn't go away just because we are suddenly in a macro-dimensional space. It is still there, Ivan. It's still present.
Right.
Its shadow, its vector is still there. Its morphology is a shape upon us, nevertheless, still.
It's fixed. Yeah. All of that, there's a fixity, I think.
Well, it's not exactly fixed.
Well,
it's just there.
Well, he talked about limitations in the previous chapter.
Yeah.
The there are boundaries and limitations in these various chambers that you're traveling through. And anyway.
The palace is not a symbolic metaphor, but a state of unobstructed vision. Okay, so the occlusions for that moment, for whatever reason, are gone. And we're sitting there directly, in a sense, standing in that vision, standing in that palace. But it's a state of unobstructed vision revealed when we have reduced the occlusion of our impaired sight and regained our attention to a much higher degree. All of us mystics who have seen the vision of the palace seem to note the same items. There's a similarity to this vision that is kind of objectively shared about. And it's the structure of the chamber remains essentially unchanged. Its lack of size and volume, its definition suggests a Roman palace, the shade on the shiner side of pearly. I've heard it described as the alabaster palace, an impossible expanse of rising plains, glistening, brilliant internal clarity, and so on. There's this simplicity, yet vibrant clarity to that place. And then he ends the paragraph in the description, which we can intuit is intended to somehow support the existence and power of a throne. God alone knows why, how and why.
Mm-hmm.
He does put jokes in there.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of jokes in this book.
And then in the next paragraph, he refers to that this is the Romans, the architectural from the Romans, of course, it was from the Greeks. And they were attempting to do what? With what did Plato always talk about, babble on about, but the ideal.
Imitating the ideal. Yeah.
Imitating
like
the ideal.
Approximating the ideal.
Bringing the ideal down into
yeah.
this plane. And what is that ideal but this mirror of the macro dimensions? And once again, so that was what Greek architecture was about. We won't get into all of that. But.
Well, it's just a capsule here. It's really an interesting historical
yeah.
capsule that he has there, because I think part of what EJ's suggesting there is that, in fact, that the whole Roman architecture, Roman science and engineering and architecture and religion and all that was derivative, and it was the Greek, you know, they admired, you know, Alexander, and they admired the older Greek religion and so on. And then what EJ's saying is that, you know, with the basis of all that were the actual mystery groups in Greek religion that were actually relying on oracles, on, you know, on voyaging, you know, with there's a lot of research about what kinds of smoke, you know, what herbs and leaves, acoustics too, yeah, but what herbs and leaves and so on they were using for voyaging and all that. So that, you know, the idea is that they were actually bringing, in the Greek context, they were actually bringing back the imagery and the reality from other dimensions.
Other dimensions.
Yeah.
And there was an interplay between the God world
yeah.
and the human
there,
world.
There was specifically known to be people that had access, actually.
Like the Oracle
channel
of Delphi.
Yeah.
The Oracle.
Yeah.
And in all of these cultures, we have the mechanisms of the ancient cultures of that specific interface. Yeah, I'm just thinking of like in some of the American Indian tribes where they had the dreaming women
mm-hmm.
who would work as a group and they would share the dream space. And then bring that back
yeah.
to the elders, who would then work with it and interpret it as to what that tribe should do.
So that's a shaman process again.
It was always in context of a problem to be solved,
mm-hmm.
because they were living in concert with that higher vision all the time. And then there's a nice, you know, there's some nice commentary then on fairy tales as well. And if you read fairy tales, you'll see that they just live, the people in the fairy tales live between worlds. They live between worlds, and there's a there's a purity about that that's quite catching.
Well, there's a lot of changing of worlds in fairy tales, for sure.
Yeah, and so
there's a lot of transformation.
Mm-hmm. And then he refers back, we don't recognize our presence in the higher dimensions, not only because of the psycho-emotional barriers, which we examined at length in relation to the perception of higher dimensions in the human biological machine as a transformational apparatus, but because of vestiges and momentum of human primate habits. That's what I was referring to. There's a momentum that each of us bring to it. They will trigger, because they those human primate traits are there, when we get into certain spaces, it'll trigger fear moments, and we'll want to leave and go back to the safety of that humanness. We might now be in the palace, but we don't think so. Our actions reveal someone who acts like a primate. As we become aware of our presence in the macro-dimensional, something about us will be slightly different, a subtle nimbus, a comparatively dim effulgence. It's an emanation.
Yeah, that's a glow.
It's a glow or an emanation. And this is an important point that I know that George and I have talked about a lot, and it's that at a certain point when you are, that's more accessible to you, that emanation becomes more real, and others can see it too and sense it. We you know, when we're there, it's a signal that tells the average macro-dimensional observer that we're on, that our presence is attuned to the macro state. Can you recognize that? Yes, you can. One, our most solid human primate views and concepts, beliefs and attitudes, perceptions and fixations are attached to us in the same vernacular way.
I think that's a coinage, yes.
I'm sure it is.
A barnacular way.
Very funny. And like we are like pig pen, and we carry that cloud of our human primateness along with us when we go into these spaces. The difference is that when we are in the spaces, the presence is more dominant than the human primateness. And when it starts to flip and the human primateness starts to gain its hand, we're ejected. That's another story. We haven't cast off this outer garment of the human primateness, and we shouldn't, nor should we. As long as we are embedded in this human coil, there's a reason to be here and to use it, and use it we should. If we seriously expect to penetrate our vision past the clouded occlusion of the visual senses, we must enter another perceptual level, the secret vision of the mystic, who allows sensation to suggest interpretation of that vision. We can use this secret in an exercise to reveal and develop the higher emotional centrum, and now a new phrase comes to us, and higher mental facilities, bringing us ever deeper and more dangerously into the domain of the shaman. And the playful participant in the self-generative cycle dance, the leela of the majestic Shakti, energy in the raw. There we go. So, how are we doing? Is anybody raising? Please.
We should hear some comments.
Why can you read a couple for us?
I'm asking Molly to read some comments.
Go ahead and take those.
Regarding is it dangerous? Going mad can be trapped in another dimension? Yeah, that's what Sinhog. I second going mad, fear of the unknown. Feeling trapped by not being able to communicate it to mom and dad and being sent away as mad. Yeah, all of these suggest the no return scenario, like, oh, how about if I get lost from my human biological machine? Conflict, read that again. Oh, yeah, conflict from identification with darkness, yeah. And resistance to awakening, yeah, I think I've experienced that one. Dangers due to reactions from the primate host,
yeah.
Right. Not being able to communicate. Seems that part of the danger is simply learning to balance the physical reality versus learning to navigate the bardo. Yeah, this is where balance is a good word. I think that's what I thought of as the danger is this idea of going mad or getting lost in the garden from the Sufis or, you know, getting out of balance is the danger. Fear of responsibility, okay.
What do you mean by that, Hawk Lady? Yeah.
Is there an objective danger that is not only due to the primate? That's a good question. I'd like to know the answer to that. As I go through transitions, things get dangerous when I bump into things. Things it's about disorientation.
And then Molly said, me too, like it comes
in very close to death. So read what the Hawk Lady said again.
It's hard to stay grounded.
So after
such travel.
So Lost Horizon, does that help you in answering your question? Yeah. Okay, but just, if anyone has a question, we should address it. We'll go ahead and take 2 weeks on this chapter.
I'm confident
we can get through it in two and not three, but because...
there's a lot to talk about with mysticism and shamanism together.
The next part of it is, there's kind of a break at this point in the chapter, but I'm going to read a couple more paragraphs. And we're starting to talk about visioning. Visioning can give us perceptual access to the macro dimensions, but actual presence in the macro dimensions requires the activation and understanding of the heart, the higher emotional centrum, which alone, but only when it's alone, is capable of producing the exalted mood necessary for access into the palace, the heart of the labyrinth, and wrapped around our presence like a mantle or shroud, keeps us safe and warm in our voyages into the coldest, most far-flung outer reaches of the labyrinth. So this is a different form of navigation this is not a navigation by spatial points on a map, but it's a navigation based on an inner state called exalted mood, the higher emotional center, which alone is capable of producing the exalted mood. Now, standing in that exalted mood is not simple. That's what the next part of the chapter is going to talk about. And I want to emphasize that part of the chapter with more clarity and depth. But I don't want to rush through that second part because there's a very, very critical element that we're going to study regarding the whole concept of the cleansing radiation. And that's, in a nutshell, where the difficulty starts. Susan gave us a hint of it. She has been through part of that, as have others, but there's no question that that's left a tangible mark, in a sense. So we're going to get there in a bit. So what else, Simon?
There's a lot in there, that's for sure. Is Harry on there tonight?
Pianjo?
Pianjo.
Star Shaper? We don't know who that
Greetings,
is.
Greetings, Star Shaper. tell you what, let me go ahead.
No, don't do that. It'll
okay.
Break the space.
All right.
Now, I'm going to go ahead and share something that I... And, Jana, can you tell me, does this show up?
I'm going to have to get it closer.
No, you have to look over there on the camera.
Close.
Yep, David, we can see that perfectly.
You just pull it back a little bit, yeah.
There
you go,
there.
Yeah, there's a tree of life.
Okay, so this, I don't know if you can hear me, but this is the tree of life, or the element. This is from the Kabbalistic team. And what they're saying is that this up here is what's called Heser, or the Godhead. Above it, actually, is something called Ansoth, the unformed or anything. And it starts to manifest, and this is, and then this takes different forms. And here we are, way down here, by the way.
We can't see, right?
We're here.
Malkuth.
We're in Malkuth, the bottom. Right in the middle of it is Kippurah, which is sometimes referred to as the heart of a labyrinth.
Can't really hear, David.
You can't hear?
Yeah, David is saying that that in the middle is Kippurah, which is the sometimes called the heart of the labyrinth. So, you know, as a map of archetypal realities. You have one of those maps is the Tree of Life. Kether is the crown, and we're down at Malkuth, the foundation.
And so this gives a little visualization to the concept of the Godhead, in a sense, manifesting on Earth. And we are now manifest. How did we wind up here then? And even in a sense, I ask the question, why are we here? Why did we take this form? Why did we rush away from the glorious chambers to manifest in a human body if there may not have been a purpose for us to do that? Maybe we would not have done it. Maybe there's something for us to uncover. There's some work for us to do. And I wonder what that might be. We're going to find that out in the second part.
That's chapter 7. Tune in next week. Would you like people to post on this chapter on
Things
of Chaos?
Yeah, and comment on what I wrote, too. This all happened. I've been kind of busy, and it just all happened, like, in the middle of the night, like at 1 o'clock or something. But it's good to get feedback. Go to chapter 7 and read and go back to chapter 6 and read some really good stuff that George and Harry wrote, and Susan left some vibrant comments. And Ivan, I think you show up there too.
Well, yeah, I had a reply, a partial reply for Harry.
So we'll take up this chapter, the second half of it, next week. But I really strongly urge you to read ahead, and we're going to see the next part of it and where we're going to head. Okay?
All right.
Any other questions, Jana, that we need to?
Questions? Boys, I'm going to talk about. Lorna says maybe we're here for service or creating.
So we don't know what that means, service or create. Deliberation.
Well, somebody posted regarding this, the Baba Black Sheep story, that at least some people who have experience voyaging in the macro dimensions may take so much responsibility as to help others escape from the world of sleep. That would be a responsibility, certainly. Taking responsibility.
Is that it then, for the moment? Okay.
Well, to be continued.
Thank you for coming. And, I look forward to next week.
Good night. Thanks, David and Ivan.
Thank you.